morning. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and it is June the 2nd, Tuesday. Boy, we're having fun and time is flying. We're going to hear from Dana first because we didn't have time to get to her when we had the testimony on Senate Bill 81. She's going to give us her wisdom, and then we'll be hearing from Mike Krause, who's in Tennessee and who has been involved in the Tennessee plan for, quote, free community college. We'll hear from him on the phone, and then we'll do our other work, a Department of Education grant, and then the two bills pertaining to TSPC. Dana, welcome. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp. For the record, Dana Richardson, Deputy Director for Legislative and Policy Affairs at the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Thanks for having me back. So I'm speaking to Senate Bill 81A. The legislature directed the HEC over the last interim to take a look at a proposal that would essentially develop a free community college type program, similar to the one that you see in Senate Bill 81. In order to do that assessment, our commission adopted a policy statement, which has been submitted to the committee, as well as a letter with our recommendations, and then the report that we contracted to kind of base our numbers off of for the costs. Excuse me. So in evaluating the proposal, the commission adopted a policy statement that whatever you do around free community college should be consistent with achieving 40-40-20 and employ the equity lens, focus on underrepresented students and non-traditional students. The commission, as I think a lot of the things I'm going to mention that they thought about are things that came up in your hearing last week. So hopefully this is just kind of a good recap of some of the questions that you raised, some of the testimony you received. One of the things the commission noted right off is the power of the message. You free community college, which means you may have a lot more students thinking about it than otherwise would, and it may even be students who could already get a good amount of aid from the feds. They just don't know that through the Pell Grant. So the message is very powerful, and the commission obviously noted that right off. The commission ultimately found that a program like this would be viable in part due to the amount of federal dollars that are available to low-income students. Ultimately, the commission recommended prioritizing investments in a redesigned Oregon Opportunity Grant, and I'll cover a little bit of, you know, why the ultimate recommendation was that. Currently, Senate Bill 81 would provide a waiver for recent high school graduates. The commission noted that wouldn't include a lot of your adult students, your returning students. And right now, about 57% of enrollment at community colleges are students over 27, so wouldn't reach those students. Also, right now, Senate Bill 81 would provide aid to, would not direct state aid to lower income students, as their tuition and fees are typically covered by the Pell Grant, the federal aid. So the commission felt like a preferable program would be one that would support low-income students in overcoming some of the other financial barriers to attending post-secondary, such as housing, food, transportation, and books. And just the third point, the tuition waiver really is just for tuition, not for these additional costs. So that's where the commission landed. We've had a variety of folks ask us, well, if you're going to do this, are there additional components to include that are important? And so I would just suggest a few, and several of these are in the -A5 amendments. Okay. But we felt like one of the important things around all of the efforts that we've done in post-secondary is not just about getting in, it's about completing. So to the extent that an additional component or components could be added that would support students not just to get in but to complete, that would be important. One possible, and this is in the -5 amendments, would be our OSAC office is piloting, Office of Student Access and Completion, is piloting a College Aspire program. So it's once they're already in, as opposed to their traditional program, which helps them get in. That's currently being piloted at two community colleges and one university, and you could scale a program like that or other programs that exist that you could provide support for. Additional policy options that you could include would be requirements to participate, like pre-enrollment counseling or participation in Aspire or something like that. You could determine whether or not the program should be made for all degrees, or you could target it for the Oregon Transfer module or for career and technical education programs. That might change your messaging a bit, but it's an option that you could use. You could also charge the heck with monitoring and evaluating the program's impact. Are you having more FAFSAs completed? Are you getting more federal dollars? How much? You know, just to make sure you're kind of really assessing the effectiveness. And then I know in the 8.5 amendments, there's also a community service component. This isn't something that the commission looked at specifically. If it were something that OSAC or the HEC were to take a lead in, that would be new for us. But we would certainly be, I think, well-positioned to monitor RACs implementing that, making sure you've got a statewide reach, that it's somewhat even as far as what students are receiving in their different communities. So I'm happy to take any questions. Those were my remarks. Thank you.
Okay. Questions for Ms. Richardson, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dana, what really struck me the other day was, and this, maybe Andrea has the answer to this more than you, I'm not sure, but what really struck me with community college testimony was that we, if there's not the capacity to do the free community college, then I question if there's the capacity to meet the middle 40 as one of our major partners in certifications and degrees. And so has there been work done? Has there been study done? Which I personally think we have to get some answers before we actually make a serious mover decision on anything related to free community college or whatever it is. Has there been a study done on capacity and what the dollars, what capital construction, seat space, instructors, the number of instructors, and all that stuff? What would it cost us in capital startup and a biennial investment in community colleges, for example, to meet the middle 40? I think, for me, that's one of the bigger questions right now is the capacity issue. We can pass a lot of stuff in this building, but if we don't have the capacity and support for our partners to go out and do it, then I'm not even sure it's aspirational at that point. It's just kind of teasing. Do you know it? Has there been work done on capacity? I'm getting Andrea shaking ahead there, Mr. Chair. I don't know if we could call her up, but that's
Co-Chair Monroe and Representative Huffman. Specifically, you might note in the commission's final recommendations that we didn't reach certainly the capital capacity question. We didn't make an assessment of that. I know that there is work, and that's what you're probably seeing from Andrea, with regard to trying to quantify some of the other capacity issues, such as, you know, course offerings and faculty, but that wasn't specifically included as the commission finalized its recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I think that's something that probably the higher ed committee or somebody should probably really look at heading into the February session and some interim work so that we can really get answers on, or maybe even the policy committee in the Senate maybe.
Right.
I think that capacity is a really big issue that we need to look at and see what truly are the needs to meet the middle 40.
Did you want to call Andrea up? Or
if she knows of some work that is or has been done, that would be great,
Mr. Chair.
Come
on up, Andrea.
Thank you. And the question's already on the table, so.
You bet.
Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee for the record, Andrea Henderson, Oregon Community College Association. And CCWD and OCCA commissioned NCHEMS a few years ago to do this work, to take a look specifically at the capacity issue around both the Middle 40 and the transfers to the universities. But let me speak directly to the Middle 40. What NCHEMS did was they took a very extensive look at Oregon's population, in migration, out migration, the pipeline, and adults. And from that did an estimate in terms of how many more certificates and degrees to reach that Middle 40 that each community college needed to produce. And then from there extrapolated out a number in terms of what that cost would be to actually get there in a way that looks at both the state investment and the student investment so that you could essentially pull the two levers to say if the state invests X amount of dollars, this is what tuition would need to be to reach there, and vice versa. So we do have that mechanism to take a look at. It hasn't been updated in 2 years, but it does produce the actual number of certificates and degrees and shows how short we are from actually reaching that.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, and I want to compliment the community colleges also on some of the things they do, because sometimes they make up for not having the space by contracting with businesses and other organizations to provide the certificate education at their place of business. So they'll say, we need to have welders, or we need to have XYZ. You've got the people who can teach it. Can we contract with you, the community college, to provide that? I don't know if we give them certificates at the end. I hope we do, because I think that's a big part of keeping track of whether we're doing this, so that they can get skill up their workforce, or in fact, as they are opening a new plant, actually come there with the new employees and work with them to get them the skills they need along those particular lines. That is one way I think that they have tried to figure out how do we do this capacity, because we don't have room on our campus to bring all of them here and train them. And business has the equipment because they're already getting ready to do it. You have the expertise. Can you do that? So I think that's one of the things, and I don't know if it came out of that study. We've been doing that with community colleges for a long time. But I tend to think that you've got to look at capacity in a lot of ways, because we can build it up so we can put them all in one place, but there may be other ways to do it. And I think the community colleges have done a good job of looking at those opportunities that exist out there. So I hope we continue to do that.
And we all know that community colleges do a lot of things that are of great benefit to the students that don't necessarily lead to a certificate. And so our rate of giving certificates to our community college students is apparently very low, and it might look like they're not doing the job of benefiting the education of their students, when in fact they're doing a lot of things that of great benefit that maybe don't lead to a certificate. Somehow we need to get at that, though, because 40% of our students in 10 years need to have the equivalent of a certificate or a two-year degree or something of that nature. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrea, something I thought of the other day in relationship to what Chairman Rowe was talking about after the Secretary of State audit came out. And, you know, as I read down through that, that's a lot of information that we've gotten in hearings over the last couple of years. I don't know that I learned anything new, but the one thing that I was questioning is, because of that, I know of, friends that were seeking a promotion within their workplace, and so they went to Columbia Gorge Community College and took two or three classes to be able to elevate them in the eyes of the employer for that promotion, and it worked. And so for them, it was a success, but that's not going to show on any degree completion or anything. It actually is a demerit for the community college. Do we do exit interviews with students to augment an audit, so when an audit comes back again, we can say, 19% of our students came specifically to take two or three classes for a promotion. Another percentage did this. Or do we just let the students leave the community college and kind of guess at why they left, what they were there for to start with?
Co-chairs Compa Monroe and Representative Huffman. I'm not aware of exactly if there are exit interviews, but we can ask about that. What I do know is we do have some efforts underway to try to track why students come and when they leave, what did they get. One of the difficulties is students change their mind after they come in the door. And so students come in to take a few classes and decide that, oh, I can do college-level work. I'm going to go for a degree or whatever. So students' efforts and intent changes. Though we are also trying to look at how can we take students that come in the door and match employment records. So we can say after they left the community college 6 months later, a year later, what is the difference in their salaries? And in a way to do that that's not tracking specific student information but can look at it as a whole, are we making a difference? It's one of the things that originally that we had wanted on our achievement compacts but didn't have the capacity yet to do that. We're hoping we can get to a point where we can track that information in conjunction with the employment department so that we know students come to us and they are better off because of it.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. if I could
yes,
also add,
go ahead.
That's a proposed key performance measure to try and get mm-hmm. at that earning gain bump.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. I've been struggling with a couple of concepts, whether it's Senate Bill 81 or we've had a tremendous amount of discussion about fifth-year programs in high school. And I know the gentleman we're going to have on our phone here from Tennessee is going to, I'm sure he has the information, but I would like to hear and get some clarification about Pell Grants. It's my understanding, we all know if we enroll in a community college and we fill out our FAFSA, even if we don't fill it out on time, I know I got some money from a Pell Grant, you know, late in the year that I thought I wasn't going to get because I missed all the timelines. But people, the statement, who can and who can't apply for a Pell Grant? That's the bottom line. Can a high school fifth-year student or a high school senior taking community college credits, can they apply for a Pell Grant?
Mr. Chair, Bob Brew happens to be here. I could give you the tip of the iceberg, but he would be able to answer that and any follow-up questions with your permission.
Okay. You want to hear from Bob?
Yes, I do, because this, I am told if we go with Senate Bill 81, then all these students would be potentially eligible for a Pell Grant, whereas the school districts are having incredible success with these fifth-year programs and wanting to see those continue. So we're right at the, you know, our crusts of our plate tectonics are rubbing against each other, and it's hard to find out which way, you know, the earthquake's going to go here.
Good morning, Senator Monroe, Representative Comp. For the record, my name is Bob Brew. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. Directly to your question, Madam Co-Chair, a student that has not completed high school is not eligible for the Pell Grant. Pell Grant is an entitlement, unlike the Opportunity Grant, where you can apply at any point during that year and receive the grant. Unlike the Opportunity Grant, where there's a fixed pot of money that once it's gone, it's gone.
Okay. Well, that's that, Mr. Follow-up. That's my understanding. You have X amount of dollars that you'll be eligible through your college career. So the statement with the, and I possibly should wait to talk to the gentleman from Tennessee, but that because of the way our high schools, our school districts have been doing this, quote unquote, we've been leaving a lot of federal money on the table. And my thought is, well, we're leaving money on the table for future access also. It's not that you're not going to use that. It's just not going to be in your fifth year.
Madam Co-Chair, so the challenge is, I think, with the Pell Grant is a student that's attending college during their fifth year really does not have any costs that the Pell is supposed to cover, like tuition or potentially living expenses, room and board and so on. They may have transportation costs or something like that. So, yeah, they would be kind of burning a year of their eligibility if they access that money that they may need later on to continue their education. The Pell Grant is only eligible, is only available for 1.5 times your typical length. So you can get 6 years of Pell Grant for a four-year degree, for instance, or 3 years of Pell Grant for a two-year degree.
Okay. Yes, that answers that question, but yeah. I'm absolutely torn about fifth-year programs versus Senate Bill 81. So,
well, fifth-year program is paid for out of the school fund.
Yes,
not out of Pell Grants.
But Mr. Co-Chair, since you made the comment, my comment back would be is that schools are finding tremendous success, and I think in part because the student is still in the school district, they connect with their teachers that they know and that can give them advice and encourage them along the way. There's some little miracle or something happening in that process that these students are being very successful, and that's hard to let go of, even at the cost of general funds for K-12.
Okay. Representative Huffman, and then we have a gentleman in Tennessee waiting for a phone call from us. So.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair, as the Education Budget Committee, I don't see how we can sine-die without answering the fifth-plus-year question this session. We need to give the department direction, because if the 15-17 biennium brings in one or two large school districts into the fifth year,
possible.
I'm not comfortable with the answers I'm getting about how it's going to impact the state school fund, and I can't see how we can adjourn without getting that question answered. I'm wondering if we should pass a bill here at the end of session that puts a temporary moratorium on fifth-year programs until we get an answer to this, because I think it's critical.
I wholeheartedly 100% agree with you.
Thank
okay,
you
can we move on now? Thank you
yes,
very
we
much.
Yes, we can move on to the agenda.
Julie.
Mr. Wilson, will you go ahead and dial? Is it Mike?
Let the more tech-savvy committee assistant do it.
Go, Julie.
Mike Krause, is that his name? Is this Mike Krause? This is Senator Rod Monroe, and we're listening to you in a Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education with respect to what we Senate Bill 81, which proposes to follow your lead and have free tuition for community college students. Can you speak to us on this issue?
I can, Senator, and I appreciate your time and the time of the members of the committee to share our experience here in Tennessee with what has thus far been a very successful foray into a last-dollar scholarship. I'll make just a couple of points and then be available to answer any questions the committee members might have. So the Tennessee Promise Program kicked off. I will tell you that we were led to the Tennessee Promise really by two things. First, the success of this sort of initiative in several of our communities. And when I say this sort of initiative, what I mean is the last dollar scholarship approach that is coupled with mentorship. That's very key to remember. And we saw this working in some of our communities. And the second point that led us to Tennessee Promise was in Tennessee, we don't have any choice. Our higher education attainment is very low. We're probably 15 states behind Oregon.
We view this as an economic development issue, and to both retain the businesses we have in Tennessee as well as to recruit new business, we knew that we needed to fundamentally alter how our high school students thought about their higher education trajectory. And so we launched the Tennessee Promise. And when we think about altering a student's higher education trajectory, what I mean by that is there are a lot of students right now in Tennessee and in Oregon that can go to college for free because of the Pell Grant. They do not know that. And merely saying, hey, you're high need, so you'll probably go for free, is not nearly as compelling as investing the resources you need to invest to be able to make the statement, community college is tuition free, which is what we did. And so just to talk a little bit about the structure of the scholarship, and I'll use a really simple example, a community college in Tennessee right now costs about $4,000. And if we have a student who, through Pell and perhaps some other aid, ends up with a $3,200 aid package, Tennessee Promise steps in and fills that $800 gap. And thus, the school is tuition-free. I will go ahead and preemptively answer something that I know some people have told me is a question that's arisen in Oregon, and it arose here as well, and that is if you're providing really just a message that gets students to the aid they would have already received, then how is that benefiting them? So think of that student that receives the full Pell Grant who won't necessarily receive any Tennessee Promise money. Is the program really benefiting them? We believe it is in two ways. First, again, I argue that student didn't know they were eligible for full Pell Grant, nor do they know what the Pell Grant is. What likely has happened is that student sits at their kitchen table and thinks, you know, we don't make very much money, so I can't go to college. Tennessee Promise has fundamentally changed the message that our high school students receive, and we've received numerous reports from our school counselors that it's changed their jobs, that they used to talk to the students that expected to go to college, and now they're talking to every student because every student expects to go to college now in Tennessee. And we also do have one very tangible data point to indicate that this is working, and that is our state's FAFSA completion, which I shared with some of your colleagues in a past committee hearing a few weeks ago. As you all know, the federal application for student aid is a difficult form. It is often a hurdle to first-generation college students. One of our first goals with Tennessee Promise was to see our FAFSA completion rate increase. It did explosively, 12% in 12 months. We're now the number one state in the nation for FAFSA, and perhaps most shocking, of all FAFSA growth nationwide, Tennessee alone comprises 40% of it. And that has occurred in the 9 months since Tennessee Promise has been launched. So we look at that data, and it's empirically proven now we've got students coming to the table that probably weren't before, regardless of whether they will receive aid from Tennessee Promise directly. My second and final point is just a low-income student that maybe receives full Pell will be put into a framework that Tennessee Promise has in place, though, that engenders success. And by that, I mean two things. First, every Tennessee Promise student is matched with a mentor. This is a volunteer community member, a Tennessean, who we have trained and vetted via a background check, who provides very focused nudging around navigating higher ed. And Tennessee Promise is often discussed as just a financial aid program. I will tell you that the mentorship is key. And the second thing we do is we make sure that the students that we're going to be sending to community college on Tennessee Promise are entering under conditions that are ready for success. And that means not attending community college part-time because it doesn't work. Students that go to community college part-time straight out of high school have much lower success rates than those that go full-time. And second, we require students to maintain momentum and enroll in college directly after high school. The data is pretty clear that if you take that break after high school to go to college, your chances of graduating drop 50% that day. And so our students will enter into a well-defined environment where we know we've tried to set them up for success. They'll have a mentor to help them navigate, whether it's registering for classes or picking a major, and they won't have to worry about the cost of tuition and mandatory fees. We think it's a game changer for our state. Indeed, we've already seen it begun to change our landscape. We're very excited about it and certainly happy to hear the discussions that are going on out there because we believe that the problems that Oregonians are facing are much the same as Tennesseans.
Mr. Krause, we need your name and title for the record.
Certainly. Mike Krause, Executive Director of Tennessee Promise and the Office of Governor Bill Haslam.
Thank you.
I'm good.
Okay, Representative Smith Warner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Krause. I hope that you can get this. I have two quick questions. Number one is, now my understanding is that the program has started in that folks are applying for FAFSA, but the first class of students has not yet entered the community college. Is that, that's my first question, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Cohort one were our high school seniors last year that just graduated, many of them last week. They will enroll as freshmen this fall. And we think we'll have between 16 and 18,000 students enrolling this fall.
Okay. And those will all be Tennessee Promise students, or that will be the increase from how many you would have had already? Can you give us some clarity on that?
I can. Those will all be Tennessee Promise students. We estimate that within our cohort of Tennessee Promise students, think of it as three types of student. One, the student that wouldn't have gone at all. We are drawing them to higher education. We estimate that to be about 20% of our students. Two, the student that may have gone to a university but will now go to a community college. That is a very small group of students, 5 to 10%. And then the remainder are students who probably would have gone to community college but are now doing so within the framework of support and within the financial support of the Tennessee Promise.
Okay, great. Thank you. And so that'll start this fall. And then, I'm sorry, that was my second question was actually, are you guys using general fund dollars for this?
No, ma'am. So this is all funded from the Tennessee Lottery Scholarship Program. Our lottery scholarship in Tennessee had amassed about a $370 million reserve. We have invested that reserve in an irrevocable trust, the interest of which funds these scholarships. We estimate our cost for our 16,000 student cohort to be about $14 million this fall. I'll just say this. We're doing this out of lottery funds. And we've probably talked to about nine states now very seriously who have contacted us about replicating Tennessee Promise, including Oregon. What I say to them is, you know, the smallest state budget in America is Delaware at, I think, $2 or $3 billion. So $14 million in the scope of pretty much any state budget in America feels like a pretty affordable amount to be able to make this statement to students. It did for us. We did it out of lottery funds. We certainly think that for some states, general funds may be the best source.
Thank you.
Representative Huffman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krause, two questions. One is, out of the 16 to 18,000 in the first cohort, how many of those do you anticipate being students that would not have attended community college otherwise?
And that is 20.8% is our estimate, Representative.
Okay, question number two, what about the capacity? Have your community colleges been challenged with how to deal with the added students?
Great question. I will share two things. First, we were very fortunate that our community colleges had really been pushed to capacity by a recessionary enrollment increase, and that probably happened in your state as well during the recession. Many of our community college students that popped into college during the recession have now left, and the capacity that was gained during the recession is still there. So from just a capacity perspective, we're very comfortable. I will tell you, we have had multiple in-depth conversations. I would argue this is probably the most deeply engaged any governor has ever been with the actual operations of community colleges. We've engaged with them at multiple times to say, do you need faculty? Do you need buildings? We're being told they do not. But the second part of capacity that I do want to emphasize is not just about bricks and mortar. It's about operational capacity to serve students, things like advisors, things like, is your college set up to navigate easily for a first-generation college student? And I will tell you, we are going through a pretty remarkable period of overhauling what the student pathway into a community college looks like. We are reducing choice. We have found that in the face of 100 choices, our students make zero. And we have found that choice has often been the enemy at these community colleges. We are trying to narrow the choices students face, go more towards default scheduling, and we're finding that to be a pretty effective intervention with other students. We're excited about deploying it with Tennessee Promise.
Okay, additional questions of members. Mr. Krause, again, Senator Monroe, co-chair of this committee. I am wondering if we were going to go for an Oregon Promise like Tennessee Promise, would you expect us to need about a 2-year lead to get it up and running?
I wish we had had that, because we did it in about 90 days. you can do it more quickly. The number one thing you would have to think about first, obviously, is your financial projections. We did ours out 3 to 4 years, and we felt good about the glide slope. The second thing you have to do is you have to build the program infrastructure, and you have to think deeply about things like, how does a student apply? How do we serve students with disabilities during the application process? It becomes a pretty student-facing process. I would recommend a year lead time. I don't think 2 years is necessary. I would also recommend, obviously, we did this pretty collaboratively. Governor Haslam called in the colleges. He called in our college access community, of which you probably have similar people in Oregon. And we tried to build a program that was really assembled using all of these people's various expertise. But we did do it in 90 days. The law was signed May 24th. And on August 15th, we began recruiting students. And by then, of course, we had to have a website and application process. The other parts of the program, though, you know, the things like what happens when a student gets to campus don't have to be built until your first cohort hits a campus. So in some ways, you could say that we probably did have a year lead time because our first cohort hasn't enrolled yet. I don't think you would need 2 years.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair?
Yes. This is Representative Betty Comp, and the question I have is, did you communicate very much with the K-12 system? We have a program that's been going on for a number of years here in Oregon where, again, students are screened and they have a process, and that the principal signs off that they think that they can be successful, and these are mostly low-income, first-generation students. Did you have such communication in this process about, communication with the school districts, or just used the community college structure with mentoring to find this success?
No, ma'am. We engaged deeply with all of our school districts. In fact, during the course of last summer, after the bill was signed, we met with all, we have 136 school districts in Tennessee. We met with the directors of almost every district, or at least provided the opportunity to meet with all school directors. And then we trained every school counselor in the state ourselves personally. We trained about 1,100 school counselors in 3 weeks. I learned where every Dunkin' Donuts in Tennessee is during that time. But what we were able to do then is we were really able to say, school districts that want to run with this, we want to equip you to run with it. We were not interested in a centralized approach when a school district was maybe more effective. And that didn't happen everywhere. We had some school districts that absolutely, we gave them our logo, and they changed the logo, and they made it the Putnam County Promise, et cetera, et cetera. We were happy to do that. In other school districts, that wasn't the right approach, and we did maintain a little more centralized outreach. But I would say we started with the K-12 districts, and then kind of ended up with the higher education folks, because again, that whole first year where you're recruiting those seniors mm-hmm. is all happening in the K-12 space.
Thank you.
Are there additional questions for the witness? Mr. Krause, we really appreciate you coming on this morning and giving us this additional information. We have had some bad experiences in Oregon with new innovative programs that were costly and that were of limited success, or some say total failure. And so we're a little gun-shy right now about taking on a new project. If we decide we want to do this, we want to make sure that we leave enough time and have the resources necessary to make it a success. Your input is certainly very helpful.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Again, I'm a resource for any of the members of the committee that might have questions. My email is mike.krause@tn.gov. And please don't hesitate to let us know how we can be of assistance moving forward.
Thank you very much. Anything further from the committee? Mr. Krause, thank you very much, and we're signing off.
Thank you, Representative.
Senator.
Okay.
Hayes the same.
Yeah, the pay's the same. Yeah. People always ask me, what's the difference between a senator and a rep? Well, senators have twice the load, work twice as hard, and get paid the same.
I have offices twice as big.
And twice as staff.
Our offices are larger.
And our offices are larger. Okay. That is definitely.
It'd be a whole other topic.
Mr. Chair, may I remind you, we still have some work sessions today.
Right. Oh, okay. All right. With that, we will turn to the Department of Grant, age 3 to grade 3, assessment grant request. Doug.
Mr. Chair.
Open and close.
You need to open the work session.
Let's open a work session on the ODE grant request.
Mr. Chair, this grant comes to you from the Oregon Department of Education. It is a request for $7 million over 4 years from the Department of Education. It deals with upgrading the kindergarten readiness assessment, as well as doing some evaluation research of existing measures. Deputy Superintendent Duncan is at the table, and I'll let him describe any more details.
Duncan?
Duncan. I'm sorry. Hey, there was a Duncan years ago, I'm sure. Mr. Saxton.
Awesome, they forget.
Co-chairs Kaufman Rowe, members of the committee, Arnie Duncan. I mean,
that's right.
It's a pleasure to be here this morning. We are, seeking approval to request a four-year, $7 million grant for age 3 to grade 3 assessment through the Institute of Education Sciences, which is a part of the United States Education Department. There are no matching dollars required and no FTE that are associated with this grant. We have partners with the University of Oregon and Oregon State University, so we're equal partners with our two colleges, with two of our many colleges. And this really is one of the things that we found recently as we've implemented the kindergarten assessment grant the last couple of years, is that our teachers and schools are telling us that we do this assessment with our kindergartners, but we don't get feedback very quickly about what the results look like. And so while the state is getting really good information about how kindergartners are arriving sort of school ready, if you will, that the effort and the time that's put into the assessment doesn't give the actual kindergarten teacher very good feedback about how to move forward with their individual classroom or an individual student. And part of what we're trying to do with this, with the dollars from this grant, is to rectify that situation. So it provides us with the ability to capture the kindergarten assessment results and make them immediately available to the classroom teacher. It's a kindergarten data entry interface that does that for us, and so that's a really good piece. And then it also provides us with some research that better predict the on track to grade 3 for students when they arrive at kindergarten, so that we can make some determination and do some research about that, and how we can intervene more effectively to make sure that they're readers by the end of third grade.
Okay, questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob, this information that's gathered will be kept private within the district, within the parent, student? How widely disseminated would it be with a student's name and identification attached to it?
Co-chairs Kaufman Rowe, Representative Huffman, I probably would need to ask my colleague Doug Costi to come forward to answer that very specifically. I know that we have institutional research board approved methodology that makes sure that the information wouldn't be shared out, so that we're making sure of that. If I could
Doug
come forward, that would be great.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp, and Representative Huffman, for your record. My name is Doug Costi. I'm Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Learning at the Oregon Department of Education. To your question, Representative Huffman, all of this student-level data will be kept using the same protocols we use for all of our assessment. It'll follow through the same privacy and confidentiality and infrastructure that we use to share results with districts. So it is not it is not available for public consumption at all with student names.
Go ahead.
Follow up. So, Doug, is there a requirement? Is this information passed on to the feds at any level for any reason, or is it contained here?
Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, no, there is no requirement. The feds have never asked for student-level information from the department.
Thank you.
Any additional questions? Yes,
Representative Thank you, Taylor. Senator Monroe. So this is for formative and interim assessments, or just for what?
These, Senator or Chair Monroe, Representative Taylor, these are for interim measures, and it's primarily the kindergarten assessment is a summative measure. So those are basically entry level as opposed to summative. We're identifying where the kids are when they enter school,
mm-hmm.
and it is, that information then is available. The other measures that we're talking about in the research portion of the grant are interim type measures. So these are measures that are done throughout the year.
And maybe I could add to yes. Co-Chairs Compton-Monroe, Representative Taylor. So this is an assessment that all kindergartners take in the state when they arrive at kindergarten within the first, like, 14 days of being there.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of this assessment is to make it really quick, to gather information about sort of their numeracy, literacy, and literacy skills, and a little bit about their self-efficacy, basically their executive function. And that assessment is summative in its nature in that it's trying to gather up their readiness for kindergarten based on really from birth to whenever they show up to kindergarten. And then what we would like would be able to have the results of that data back in the hands of the teacher as quickly as possible so they can begin to think about their instructional practice with each individual child or their classroom as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that helps with your question.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Monroe. I'm having technological problems for some reason this morning. So I was just reading here on the agenda, and I wanted to understand. It says age 3 to grade 3, but what we're really talking about is just for kindergarten.
Let me clarify, if I could, Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Taylor. There are two components to the grant application. The first component is to develop the application for the kindergarten assessment so that the teachers can have immediate access to that information. The second component will be to analyze the various measures being used in the pre-K world and align those to those being used in the K-3 world. These are not smarter balance type assessments. Okay. These are the other measures. So the research portion of the grant is to look at those other measures and look at the measures being used and identify what is actually the predictive number on the outcome of those various measures to predict on track to third grade literacy and numeracy skills.
I just have one last question, Senator Monroe, and I promise. Thank you. So will each district then be able to select what type of assessment they want to use, or will there be uniformity across the state?
Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Taylor, districts will be allowed to use the assessments of their choice in the interim, not the kindergarten assessment. All of them will have to use the kindergarten assessment, but the pre-K and K-3 measures, districts and early learning providers have their option in terms of what they use, with the exception of OPK that uses TS Gold. So what we're trying to do is correlate those results of those various measures to the kindergarten assessment and to the K-3 measures that are being used within districts.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Huffman?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there going to be an ongoing maintenance of effort, or is this to fund a pilot program and assess it after the pilot program is completed?
Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Huffman, this is to build the actual interface, and then once that is built, we will need a little bit of money for ongoing maintenance, but it won't be significant. It should be absorbed within the department's budget.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Doug, so if I can understand what you've just been relating, so there's two components to this grant. You will be able to build infrastructure in your data system, plus there will be the assessment. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, technically it's to build the application is one outcome, and the second outcome is really just to analyze the different measures being used. So it's less about the infrastructure, it's more about a platform for entering the kindergarten assessment and allowing districts to have access to that. So there isn't any other technical infrastructure other than that application would feed our technical infrastructure. It does nothing to the underlying infrastructure.
Follow up, Mr.
Go
Kocher.
Ahead.
I appreciate your initiative. So this would be a $7 million grant from the feds. Mm-hmm. And so that otherwise we would be looking or putting out an RFP of our own that would cost us general fund monies if we didn't do this.
Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Comp, that is correct.
Okay. The other follow-up is, what do we know about the Institute of Education Sciences? I'm not a testing geek, mm-hmm. and not that you are. But are we going to need, the bottom line is, are we going to need training for our teachers? And is that part of this grant? Or there's all these things come into the picture and it gets a little cloudier. First it starts out really clear and then it gets cloudier and cloudier and principals get crankier and crankier. So,
Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Comp, thank you for that question. Yes, there is professional development embedded in this grant. So as we analyze the results, what we will be looking at also is providing professional development for end users of the system.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Based on what both of you have already said and looking at the grant request, so you're not asking for FTE, correct? So then, once the application is good to go, the training is in place, is there staff at ODE that will be able to manage the ongoing implementation of this without general fund dollars?
Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Springer, yes. In fact, this is a multi-agency grant. It includes the Early Learning Division as well as the Oregon Education Investment Board, and we're partnering on this opportunity with all three entities.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And it says here, the grant in an amount up to $7 million. I certainly assume that's over the four-year period. Do you anticipate asking for that $7 million, or is it going to take less than that?
Co-Chair Monroe, Representative Springer, we're doing the final analysis of our budget this week. We anticipate asking for the entire $7 million. Historically, we've seen where the Institute of Educational Sciences has reduced the ask or the request based on the amount of funds and the number of states requesting funds.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. When I look at these grant requests, because sometimes we get excited, there's money on the table, let's go get the money. And we don't think about the subsequent cost mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. that free money. And so in hearing that there won't be asks for FTE and additional funds to fund this, certainly this is something I can support with those in mind.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Thank you very much.
You.
Mr. Wilson, we need a motion to approve the request.
That is right.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, I respectfully request approval to apply for a four-year, $7 million grant for the age 3 to grade 3 assessment grant from IES.
Okay. You've heard the motion. Is there discussion of the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Okay, go get your grant. Mr. Wilson, close the work session
we'll
on
need
the.
A carrier on this?
Oh, a carrier.
Oh, I can't get
We'll need a full committee.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we need somebody that's on full. Are you on full, Kathleen?
No. I didn't think so. I thought you were looking for someone for something else. I was trying to
help. Representative Huffman.
Representative Huffman, you're on full, right?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Huffman will carry this to full, and we don't need carriers in beyond that. Just for grants, we just need to go to full. Okay, with that, we'll close the grant request for ODE and open public work session on House Bill 2411. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 2411 is a fee bill for the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. It is tied to the budget. It has a number of items in it, which you heard about last week from Ms. Chamberlain. The first one being that the name is changed from Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, or TSPC, to the Professional Educator Standards Board. I'll come back to that a little later. It also changes some of the licensing laws and significantly reduces the number of different types of licenses to a much smaller and manageable number, changes the structure, as you heard last week, and it also increases the maximum fee the commission may charge for a number of licenses. They're there on the first page of my memo. Overall, this is expected to raise roughly $1.1 million during this biennium, and it is the fee increases would be effective January 1 of next year, 2016. Please keep in mind that the basic fees have not increased since 2005-07 for almost 10 years. And also keep in mind that these are in terms of this bill, these are the maximum amounts that the commission may charge. You also, the budget you will hear next anticipates an increase in the basic teacher licenses from $100 to $140. So these are just, in this bill, you're setting the maximums, but they still need to come back and get the fees increases in the future ratified by the legislature. So even though you're raising the maximum fee, if they can't go above that $140, if you pass the next bill without coming back to you anyways. So that is sort of the oversight or the summary of the bill. There is one amendment, which is a committee amendment.
Okay, would you explain the amendment?
The amendment, all it does is take out the name change from the, it keeps the current name as Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. It is the A-A2 amendments. It's rather long because that part of the bill took up or that particular part of the bill took up the most of the pages in the bill, so it is long. So that is in what the amendment does, and it keeps everything else in the same, including the increases in the fee limits as well as the changes in the licensing structure.
Questions for Mr. Wilson? Representative Huffman.
Well, I want to make a comment, Mr. Chair, so whenever you're ready for...
Well, why don't we go ahead and take a motion, and then would the comment be on the amendment or on the whole measure?
Whole measure.
Okay, well, let's take care of the amendment first then. Representative Comp, motion on the A2 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. I move the -A2 amendment to House Bill 2411.
And the -A2 amendment simply retains the current name, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and deletes the references to the Professional Educator Standards Board. Okay, discussion of the amendment. Any opposition to the amendment? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Now, the measure as amended, and we'll take a motion and then we'll have discussion. Representative Comp.
I move House Bill 2411-A to the full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Heard the motion. Discussion. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish we had had the results of the audit that has been requested by the co-chairs coming into this session. We don't. So I'm going to have to be opposed to all things TSPC this morning. I think we need answers to a number of questions before we give spending limitation authority, increasing of fees and whatnot. I want to support our teachers. That's not what this is all about. But I can't support the agency in its current form and requests for changes in licensing and changes in fees, et cetera, and so on.
Okay. Additional discussion, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You'll see as this bill went through the House Ed Policy Committee, it was unanimous, including me. And since that time, we've had further discussion regarding TSPC. This body passed out a bill to audit through the Secretary of State's office. Those results are to be completed and brought back to this body in February.
Yes.
And because of that, because we have unknowns there, we need to look at that. I'm concerned that any change we make prior to that will skew, taint, or fog the results of that audit.
Okay.
And so for that reason, I'm not going to support this in this committee. I'm not going to support this on the floor. I think we need to look at an audit of what we have today and evaluate based on what we have today, opposed to creating changes in the midst of that audit, and then have a conversation in February. I'm quite concerned that the conversation in February, this kind of sets that up to fail, in my opinion, and I'm concerned that we're going to have conversations about what a particular result is and why we can't count that result because we had other moving parts. Yeah. So for that reason, enough said, I'm going to be a no.
Okay. Additional discussion? Senator Roblin.
I understand exactly where my colleagues are coming from. On the other hand, I believe if we know that we have had a difficult time having the personnel and others to do the job that we need to have done to give certificates in a timely manner and other things, which is part of the deal, that if we just wait another year so that will continue because the audit finds out that what they needed was more staff, we have put at risk people's lives and jobs during that year. And so my feeling is that the audit needs to go on. We need to find out whatever we can find out from that audit. But at the same time, moving this bill forward allows us to catch up on some business that we need to catch up on. We've already seen some changes that they used some resources that they had, which has made a difference. I hope that the auditors can have that conversation and talk to employees and find out all the different kinds of things so we have information on which we can judge the future. But to just hold in place something that we knew was not working, and also knowing that a few years before that, it was on track and doing okay with respect to getting certificates out, I will be voting for this and hope that we solve the problem that we have there and that any structural problems that the audit can find out we can deal with in the future. So I appreciate the comments.
Further discussion of the motion? I've thought about this a lot, and it strikes me that the agency has come to us and said, I don't have the resources to do the job. We've heard much criticism of the agency. It seems to me that it's reasonable on a temporary basis, and the recommendation for that you'll see in 5538 for increases in staffing are all temporary. Is that right, Mr. Wilson?
Most of them are temporary.
Most of them are temporary. So we give them the temporary resources that they ask for, and then we audit them before next February. The Secretary of State has promised to do that audit, has made it a priority, and will do the audit, and then come back to us. And we will know then, where the agency is, and what additional resources or changes need to be made.
Okay, with that, the motion is to approve House Bill 2411 with the A2 amendment. Why don't we just call the roll on that?
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Springer?
No.
Representative Taylor?
Yes.
Representative Smith-Warner?
Yes.
Co-chair Comp?
Aye.
Representative or Senator Thompson?
Nope.
Senator Rowland?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye. Motion carries. Okay, we'll close the. Oh, we need carriers on the floor. And to Full Ways and Means, Senator Roebland.
Fine.
To Full Ways and Means and to the Senate, and Representative Comp will carry on the House. Okay, with that, I'll close the work session on 2411 and open a work session on Senate Bill 5538, which is the budget bill for TSBC. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members, this is the budget bill, Senate Bill 5538 for the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. It does anticipate the passage of House Bill 2411, which you just passed out of the subcommittee. You do know the background or the duties of the commission. Licensed teachers set standards for the licenses, also review and set standards and accreditation visits for the teacher training programs across the state, and also investigate and, where merited, take disciplinary actions on those licensees under their purview. Quick things on the budget and other issues for the TSPC to take into account. Over the past years, revenues for the commission have fallen significantly as fewer people have applied for licenses. The numbers there are in the memo, and we'll go over them. But in recent months, as the economy as well as sort of the outlook for the state school fund have improved, the revenues have started to increase some again, but not to the rate that the budget can be sustained with them. In terms of reacting to those declining revenues in the past, they eliminated a number of positions. As you can see on the front page table, in 11-13, there were 24.23 FTE, and in the current service level, that had fallen to below 19 or 20, and effectively, those positions had not all been filled throughout the 13-15 biennium, as well as part of the 11-13 biennium. So they eliminated positions, left a number of positions vacant, reduced other spending, and then also used their ending balances and getting that below sort of the level of comfort. That, of course, resulted in, were major factors in resulting into backlogs and investigations, processing licenses and responding to emails and phone calls. As you have probably heard Ms. Chamberlain say, they have increased staffing resources. Recently, these are unsustainable too far in the future with the current revenue structure, but they did increase through temporary employees and overtime some of the revenue or some of the functions to take down those backlogs in some of the key areas. And there have been some improvements, it appears, from the data that's been presented. Another factor to take into account is there is a new online licensing system. It's coming on, coming forward hopefully sometime this fall. And that should also improve the processing time as well as the ease that licensees have in renewing and applying for their licenses. This is supported financially by a $10 fee per license at the transaction level. This is outside of the state budget with an agreement that Department of Administrative Services, the commission, and the outside vendor has, but it will provide the necessary online licensing system that the commission needs. It's now very much a paper, envelope, mail, phone call system. Hopefully that will alleviate some of the demand for those services. And finally, it does assume the passage of 2411, and also, as people have talked about, the Secretary of State's audit. is due back here for your February session, probably in time for you to review the progress that the division or the commission have made, as well as to take a look at the budget again to see what you what is proposed here today is sufficient or too much or whatever it might be, and changes can be made at that time. So if you will turn to the work session document, I will go through that in detail. It should be on your screen. It is in the typical format that you'll see in the future for the other agencies in front of you. Unfortunately, ODEs and the HEC budget will be much larger than this. So go through this. If you turn to page 2 of 5, this is the first package. Package 101, which just reflects the fee increases that have been described before. It is forecasted to bring in a little over $1.1 million and is effective July 1 of 2016. The basic teacher fee will go from $100 for a 3 to 5 year license to $140 fee for the same 3 to 5 year licenses. As a side note, this is one of the cheapest professional licenses that the state has in terms of its licensing entities. There's also, as I've also discussed, the $10 convenience fee. Our recommendation is to approve the licensing or these fee increases to generate the necessary revenues for the rest of the budget that's being recommended. 2 years from now, and in addition in February, but the February time period won't really have any history on terms of the fee increases. But 2 years from now, you should have some be able to take carefully look at the cash flow to see if those fees are sufficient. It will not build up the ending balance for this upcoming biennium very far, but past that, it should be fine, because many of the positions that are being recommended here are limited duration in nature and do not automatically roll up into the 17-19 biennium. So that, Mr. Chair, is package 101. Package 103 on page 3 of 6, this deals with the administrative staff of the agency. These are not in any priority order. These are numbers given in terms of back in putting together the budget at agency request level. This particular budget as an executive administrative support position, as proposed, a full-time position to provide additional technical and professional support for the activities dealing with budget, finance. I guess these didn't get rotated, and I apologize.
That's all right.
When we posted them, okay. Security planning, rules, preparation, responsibilities, and a number of other functions that the current staff, mainly the executive director, and to some lesser extent the deputy director, provides. We are recommending, instead of a full-time position, a half-time position. We don't feel that this is necessarily needs a full-time position. The work is currently being done, albeit at a level that needs some improvement in terms of the time available to the executive director. And also, package 104, if approved, will free up some of the deputy director's time to also assist in these admin functions where appropriate. The other significant change in the package is that we are recommending, instead of a PEMA, which is a management position, not necessarily supervisor role, but a management position, that it be an operations policy analyst 2, and our recommendation does reflect that. And in other packages that are still to come, there was a rent included in the estimate of the package. They are not expanding their footprint, so there is not any need for any rent in the budget, and that has been factored into the LFO recommendation. Package 104 deals with your accreditation staff. This is a primary function of the agency to assess and oversee and accredit the, 18 educator professional preparation programs in the institutions, both private and public, across the state. Currently, the deputy director makes this his primary function, but also has many other functions. But recent actions taken by the commission in terms of new standards and also by requirements of the federal government, this role has had increasing responsibilities, and this position is in response to that. It will assist on training for the on-site teams that do the accreditation. It will provide technical assistance to the programs and also assist in the administration of the education teacher performance assessment for student teachers. Again, our modifications to this original proposal is to take out the rent, and also, given that this position can't be hired by July 1, reduce the number of months on the position. Package 105 deals with the licensing staff. It proposes to add two limited duration positions to take care of the current licensing and responding to backlog requests on emails and phones. One of the positions would assist in evaluating applications and issuing licenses. The other position would respond to phone, emails, and walk-in customers. Both are proposed as limited duration. Both of these address areas of real concern by critics of the commission and those licensees. Recent experience has shown improvement in these areas as resources have been added in the past few months, but those resources are non-sustainable given the current resources available without this package. We are recommending the two positions, limited duration again, and our adjustments again relate to the rent as well as delaying the hiring of one of the positions. The other position, they plan to take the temporary employee they have in place and transfer it to a limited duration position. So that position can come on right away on July 1. And then the final package, package 802, deals with the investigative resources. It proposes two limited duration positions, again limited duration, to respond to the ongoing backlogs and investigations, as well as digitizing investigative files already in place or have been processed, or in new incoming investigation reports. So they're adding one investigator to position and one office assistant to for the scanning purposes. Our recommendation is to approve both positions, both limited duration, but scale back the office assistants or the person doing the scanning to only the first year of the biennium. Given the numbers the agency gave me, I don't believe they need that position for the entire biennium. So they should get the work that is necessary for the scanning done during the first year. And we also urge the commission and the staff to take a look and sort of come down and decide on a case management software that they are looking at prior to doing a lot of the scanning to make sure the scanning they're doing fits into the new case management system. So that, Mr. Chair, are our recommendations on terms of the budget. Overall, we're recommending, as you can see on page 3 of our memo, an other funds expenditure limitation of $6,114,729, all other funds limitation, 26 positions and 24.38 FTE.
Questions for Mr. Wilson? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, we've worked together for a long time on a lot of different budgets, and I don't want to be overly critical, but to me it seems like this is Groundhog Day. The last probably three biennia, I've sat and listened to the same things in the budget that we're attempting once again to correct. Investigators, backlogs, stuff like that. But it seems like I hear the same need and story every biennium. And I recall, I think it was 2011, where we, I think mid-term somewhere, we approved an additional investigator position to get caught up. I mean, I apologize because, you know, we hear a lot of information, we hear a lot of budgets, not just here, but I'm hearkening back to the Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee also, but it just seems like this is the only agency where I've really ever gotten that feeling like it's just Groundhog Day again. The others have had challenges. We've worked through them. Correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't it seem like we dealt with the same, and maybe you don't have to answer. It just seems like we deal with the same challenges every biennium, and I don't know why we can't make progress.
I will, Mr. Chair, respond in part to that. Even though there have, and I can't date back prior to the current biennium or the 2013 session, because this was not my assignment, and I can't recall if sometime during that 11-13 period. But keep in mind that for some of those positions that were approved earlier on, they were never filled, or they were filled and then had to be laid off because of the declining revenues. So I think this is really, if you want to call it a Groundhog Day, I can understand where you're coming from, but it also could be called a catch-up day to try to get them to a place that they can succeed.
Fair enough.
Additional discussion? Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two things. First of all, I just want to go back. I know I brought this up in the one of the earlier public hearings about this, but the idea in the KPMs of having voicemail on and responded to in at the agency, and I'm just not sure of the technicality of how of what we do to make sure that is a thing. And number two, I would just share the concern about that I think I mentioned also in that I get and agree with the idea of limited duration to get ourselves caught up, and I think and to not be included in the roll-up, and I would just be concerned that all the public contact positions to actually get the work done and rolled up are limited duration, but the permanent is a manager position, and so I would point that out with some trepidation, particularly as we are looking for the audit results and how just as a place to keep an eye on.
Well, everybody knows we have to do something, and now's the time. Decisions may have been put off in the past. Certainly decisions about resources were delayed in the past. Mr. Wilson has done a wonderful job of determining the necessary resources, of recommending limited duration positions, not permanent positions, of scaling back even the limited duration positions from what the agency requested, where he felt like they were trying to take too big a bite of the apple. I believe that this will allow us within 8 months to know what the audit says, and the audit will be done with the necessary resources. Really probably wouldn't be fair to the agency to tie their hands and then do an audit. So we're not doing that. We're giving them the necessary resources, but not too much. We're giving it to them on a more or less temporary basis, because we know that we'll be coming back in February and have an opportunity to review the audit and to make adjustments. And just seems to me that that's the responsible thing for the budget committee to do at this point. I will once again thank my co-chair, Representative Comp, and thank especially Mr. Wilson for honing this measure and giving the agency the resources they need and giving us the opportunity then to review the audit come in about 8 months and make some permanent decisions. Representative Comp, a motion.
Mr. Chair, and Doug, tell me if I'm on the wrong page here. I move the LFO recommendation to Senate Bill 5538.
Okay. Questions? Any further discussion?
Here's a question.
Yes,
Representative Huffman.
Mr. Chair, I've heard members do this a lot over the years, and I've never known if it was worthwhile or effective or not, voting no to send a strong message to the commission and the governor and leadership that and the auditing team that I take this very seriously, and I think things need to be checked into seriously, and so that's to characterize my no vote.
And Representative Huffman, I appreciate your participation in this committee and your leadership in this committee, but there are times when you're in leadership when you have to act like a leader, and there are times when you're not in leadership when you're allowed to dissent, and I recognize that.
Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
I just had a question. Were you suggesting that we all vote no to send a message?
No, Senator, I wasn't.
Okay. Those people who are opposed to the measure, Representative Huffman, Representative
yes.
Springer, and Senator Thompson, any other opposition? The motion carried. And
Mr. Chair, we still have a number of steps. I apologize.
Oh,
we can
okay.
get it done quick. The performance measures are also in your packet. Our recommendation is not to change any of the targets or any of the measures at this time. I think it's premature given the audit and the level of resources, getting them back to where they need to be to perform, or at least temporarily back there before the audit comes in. So those are the key performance measure recommendations. There is also a budget note, mainly instructing the commission to report back to the Ways and Means Committee during the 16 legislative session, or to the Interim Joint Committee on Ways and Means prior to that. And those things are dealing with fee-related revenue progress and addressing the backlogs, impact on the workload of the new online licensing system, and progress on the scanning, things I'm sure the audit will also be taking a look at. So with that, Mr. Chair, there's a motion for the amendment to be taken.
Okay.
If there's no objection to the performance measures or the budget note.
Would that be in the dash one amendment?
The budget note and performance measures will be part of the overall bill
okay.
acceptance.
Okay. So, Madam Co-Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 5538.
Okay. Is there objection to the motion? Representative Huffman and Representative Springer object?
Just to be consistent, Mr. Chair.
Just to be consistent. Okay, motion carries. Final motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 5538 to the full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, again, objections? Representative Huffman, Springer, Senator Thompson, motion carries. And carriers, can we use the same carriers, Senator Roblin and Representative Comp?
Yes.
Okay. Anything further, Mr. Wilson? We're adjourned 1 minute late.
And what's tomorrow, Deb?
There's accelerated learning bill, if I... There's accelerated learning bill, if I...
Tomorrow.